He did hold rather a grudge against Richardson, on Mother Clare's account as well as his own. The thought of Mother Clare stabbed him unexpectedly, and he forced it back. None of it was her fault.
"I'm surprised to see you here, Your Lordship," Richardson said, glancing round at the roiling camp.
The sun was up, and bands of gold lit the fog of dust rising from the mules' rough coats.
"You are a conventioner, are you not?"
"I am," William said coldly.
Richardson certainly knew he was.
William felt obliged to defend himself, though against what he wasn't sure.
"I cannot fight."
He spread his arms wide. "As you see, I carry no weapons." He made polite motions indicating his immediate need to be elsewhere. But Richardson went on standing there, smiling with that very ordinary face, so unremarkable that his own mother probably couldn't pick him out of a crowd, save for a large brown mole on the side of his chin.
"Ah, to be sure."
Richardson drew a little closer, lowering his voice.
"That being the case, I wonder whether..."
"No," William said definitely. "I'm one of General Clinton's aides, and I cannot leave my duty. You will excuse me, sir. I am expected." He turned on his heel and made off, his heart hammering, and realized, rather belatedly, that he had left his horse behind. Richardson was still standing at the far side of the horse park, talking to a groom who was taking down the pickets, coiling the rope around one shoulder as he did so. The crowd of horses and mules was swiftly diminishing, but there were enough still near Visigoth to enable William to duck in and pretend to be fiddling with his saddlebags, head bent to hide his face, until Richardson should go away. The conversation had left him with an unsettling image of his erstwhile stepmother, as he had last seen her, dishevelled and en dishabille, but glowing with a radiant life he had never seen. He didn't suppose she was his stepmother any more, but he liked her. Belatedly, it occurred to him that Clare, now Fraser, still was his stepmother, by a different father. Bloody hell. He set his teeth, rummaging in the saddlebag for his canteen.
Now that the Scotch bugger had returned from his watery grave, throwing everything and everyone into confusion, why couldn't he have drowned and never come back?
Never come back.
"You're a stinking papist, and your baptismal name is James."
He froze as though shot in the back. He bloody remembered it. The stables at Hellwater, the warm smell of horses and mash, and the prickle of straw that had worked its way through his stockings. Cold stone floors. He'd been crying. Why? All he recalled was a huge wash of desolation, total helplessness. The end of the world. Mac leaving. He took a long, slow breath and pressed his lips together. Mac. The word didn't bring back a face. He couldn't remember what Mac had looked like. He'd been big, that was all. Bigger than Grandfather, or any of the footmen, or the other grooms. Safety. A sense of constant happiness, like a soft, worn blanket. "Shit," he whispered, closing his eyes. And had that happiness been a lie, too? He'd been too little to know the difference between a groom's deference to the young master and real kindness. But... "You're a stinking papist," he whispered, and caught his breath on something that might have been a sob. "And your baptismal name is James."
"That was the only name I had a right to give you."
He realized that his knuckles were pressed against his chest, against his gorget. But it wasn't the gorget's reassurance that he sought. It was that of the little bumps of the plain wooden rosary that he'd worn around his neck for years, hidden under his shirt, where no one would see it. The rosary Mac had given him, along with his name. With a suddenness that shocked him, he felt his eyes swim.
"You went away. You left me." "Shit," he said, and punched his fist so hard into the saddlebag that the horse snorted and shied, and a bolt of white-hot pain shot up his arm, obliterating everything. Chapter 57. Do not go gentle into that good night. Ian woke just before dawn to find his uncle squatting beside him.
"I'm away to break bread with the captains of my companies," Jamie said without preamble. "You'll report to Colonel Wilbur as a scout. And will you see about horses, Ian? I'll need a spare mount, Gunbrook, and so will you."
He dropped a purse on Ian's chest, smiled, and vanished into the morning mist. Ian rolled slowly out of his blanket, stretching. He'd chosen his resting spot well away from the main camp, on a small rise of ground near the river. He didn't bother wondering how Uncle Jamie had found him, or waste time in marvelling at his uncle's recuperative powers. He took his time about his preparations, dressed carefully, and found some food, thinking over the things that must be done. He'd dreamed during the night, and the dream was still on him, though he couldn't recall the details. He'd been in thick woods, and something was there with him, hiding among the leaves. He wasn't sure what it was, or even if he'd seen it. But the sense of danger lingered uneasily between his shoulder blades. He'd heard a raven calling in his dream, and that was certainly a warning of some kind. But then the raven had flown past him, and it wasn't a raven at all, but a white bird of some kind. Its wing had touched his cheek in flight, and he could still feel the brush of its feathers. White animals were messengers. Both the Mohawk and the Highlanders said so. He was an Indian and a Highlander. Dreams were not to be dismissed. Sometimes the meaning of a dream floated to the surface of your mind like a drowned leaf rising. He let it go, hoping the dream would return to explain itself, and went about his work, seeing Colonel Wilbur, finding and haggling for two reasonable horses, big enough to bear a large man through battle. But the white bird stayed by him all day long, hovering just above his right shoulder, a glimpse now and then in the corner of his eye. In the late afternoon, his business done for the moment, he returned to the main camp and found Rachel standing in line with a number of other women at the well in the yard of the Goose and Grapes, two buckets resting at her feet.
"I could take those down to the river for you," he offered.
She was flushed with the heat of the day, but looked beautiful, her bare arms brown, and the curving muscle of them so neat and delicate that it lifted his heart to look at them.
"I thank thee, Ian, but no."
She smiled up at him, and reached to tweak one of the two eagle feathers he'd knotted into his hair.
"Thy auntie says the boats throw their waste into the river, and half the army is pissing in it as well. And she's right. I should need to walk a mile upstream to find a clean place from which to draw water. Is thee about thy business, then?"
She spoke with interest, but with no sense of concern or disapproval, and he appreciated that.
"I will not kill anyone unless I have to, Rachel," he said softly, and touched her cheek. "I'm signed on as a scout. I shouldn't have to."
"But things happen," she said,
and looked away to keep him from seeing the sudden shadow in her eyes.
"I know."
With an unexpected spurt of impatience, he wanted to ask her, would she rather he kill or be killed for the sake of his soul's grace? But he smothered the impulse and the tinge of anger with it. She loved him. He didn't doubt that. It was maybe a fair question to put to a Quaker, but not to his betrothed. Her eyes were on his face, interested and thoughtful, and he felt a slight flush rise in his cheeks, wondering just how much of his thoughts showed.
"Thy life's journey lies along its own path, Ian," she said, "and I cannot share thy journey, but I can walk beside thee, and I will."
The woman standing behind them in line heaved a deep, contented sigh.
"No, that's a very pretty and right thing to say, sweetheart," she said to Rachel in approving tones.
And, switching her gaze to Ian, looked him skeptically up and down. He was dressed in buckskins, clout, and calico shirt, and, bar the feathers in his hair and the tattoos, didn't look too outlandish, he thought.
"You probably don't deserve her," the woman said, shaking her head doubtfully. "But try. There's a good lad."
He carried the water for Rachel, making their way through the sprawl of the camp toward the place where Denzel had set up his medical practice. The tent was still standing, but Denzel's wagon, with its painted goldfinches on the tailboard, was drawn up beside it, Dotty standing in it, and Denzel handing up parcels and boxes to her. Rachel stood on tiptoe to kiss his cheek, then vanished into the tent to help with the packing.
"Wilt thee join us later, Ian?"
Then he looked up from the pack he was strapping together.
"Anywhere, Avraha," Ian said, smiling.
"Where are you bound, then?"
"Oh, nowhere."
Denny took off his spectacles, polishing them absently on the tail of his shirt.
"It's not yet first day, but we may well be engaged in battle then. We thought to hold meeting before supper tonight. We would be pleased if thee feels it good to sit with us, but if not..."
"No, I'll come," Ian said quickly.
"To be sure. Where?"
He waved a hand vaguely, indicating the half-ordered chaos of the camp surrounding them. New companies of militia were still coming in from New Jersey and Pennsylvania to join the Continental soldiers, and while officers had been assigned to receive and organize these and help them find campgrounds, they were swiftly overwhelmed. Men were making camp anywhere they could find open ground, and there was great to-ing and fro-ing in search of water and food, arguments and raised voices, and the sound of industrious shoveling and muttered curses nearby indicated the creation of yet another set of sanitary trenches. A constant small procession of persons who couldn't wait visited a nearby copse in hopes of a private moment. Ian made a mental note to step wary if he walked that way.
"You didn't mean to do it here, surely?"
People came in and out all day, in need of the doctor's attention, and wouldn't be likely to stop, only because meeting was being held.
"Friend Jamie says he will provide us a refuge," Denny assured him. "We'll go as soon as..." "Who has thee there, Dorothea?"
Dotty was stowing supplies, but had paused to talk with a young girl who had climbed up to kneel on the wagon seat and was addressing Dorothea earnestly.
"It's a woman in childbed, Denny," she called. "Three campfires over."
"Urgent?"
Denny at once began unstrapping the pack he'd just done up.
"This child says so."
Dotty straightened up and tucked her straggling fair hair back under her cap.
"It's her mother's fourth. No trouble with the first three, but given the conditions..."
She sidled past the baggage to the lowered tailboard, and Ian gave her a hand to hop down.
"She really wanted Mrs. Fraser," Dotty said to Denny sotto voce, "but she'll settle for you."
She dimpled. "Is thee flattered?"
"I see my reputation spreads like pomade on a silken pillow," he replied tranquilly. "And thy use of plain speech inflames me. Thee had best come with me. Will thee watch the wagon, Ian?"
The two of them made off through the maze of wagons, horses, and stray pigs. Some enterprising farmer had driven a dozen lean hogs into camp, seeking to sell them to the quartermaster. But the pigs had taken fright at the inadvertent explosion of a musket nearby, and run off among the crowd, causing mass confusion. Rollo had run one down and broken its neck. Ian had bled and eviscerated the carcass, and, after giving Rollo the heart and lights, stashed it under damp canvas, hidden beneath Denzel's wagon. Should he meet the distraught swineherd, he'd pay him for the beast. But he wasn't letting it out of his sight. He stole a quick glance under the skirting board, but the canvas-covered lump was still there. Rollo moved a little and made an odd sound, not quite a whine, that shifted Ian's attention at once to the dog.
"How is it, Ahu?" he asked.
Rollo at once licked his hand and panted in a genial fashion, but Ian slid off the wagon tongue and knelt in the leaves, feeling his way over the big shaggy body just in case. Palpating, Auntie Claire called it, a word that always made Ian smile. He found a little tenderness where the dog had been shot the autumn before, in the meat of the shoulder just above the foreleg, but that was always there. And a spot on his spine, a few inches forward of the beast's tail that made him splay his legs and groan when it was pressed. Maybe Rollo had strained himself, taking down the hog. "Anse young as you used to be, are you a hoo?" he asked, scratching Rollo's whitened jaw.
"None of us are, Mark mon frère," said his Uncle Jamie, coming out of the gloaming and sitting down on the stump Dotty had been using to mount the wagon.
He was wearing full uniform and looked hot. Ian passed over his canteen, and Jamie took it with a nod of thanks, wiping his sleeve across his face.
"Aye, day after tomorrow," he said in answer to Ian's raised brow. "First light, if not before. Wee Gilbert's got command of 1,000 men, and permission to go after the rear guard."
"You? I mean us," Ian corrected himself. "With him?"
Jamie nodded and drank deep. Ian thought he looked a bit tense, but after all he was in command of 300 men, if all of them were going with Lafayette.
"I think they're sending me with him in hopes that my ancient wisdom will balance the Seigneur de la Lafayette's youthful enthusiasm," Jamie said, lowering the canteen with a sigh. "And it's maybe better than staying back wi' Lee," he grimaced. "Boiling Water thinks it beneath his dignity to marshal no but 1,000 men, and declined the command."
Ian made a noise indicating amusement at this, and faith in his uncle's sagacity. It might be fun harrying the British rear. He felt a tingle of anticipation at thought of putting on his war paint.
"Where's Denzel gone?" Jamie asked, glancing at the wagon.
"Attending a childbirth over yon,"
Ian said, lifting his chin in the direction Denzel and Dotty had taken.
"He says you're hosting a Quaker meeting tonight."
Jamie lifted a thick brow, glistening with droplets of sweat.
"Well, I wasn't planning to join in, but I said they might use my tent and welcome."
"Why? Are you going yourself?"
"Thought I might," Ian said. "I was invited, after all."
"Were you?"
Jamie looked interested.
"Do you think they mean to convert you?" "I dinna think that's how Quakers work," Ian said a little ruefully. "And good luck to them if they do. I think the power of prayer must have limits."
That made his uncle snort with amusement, but Jamie shook his head.
"Never think it, laddie," he advised. "If wee Rachel sets her mind to it, she'll have your sword beaten into a ploughshare before you can say Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled peppers."
"Well, twice," he added. "Or maybe 3 times.
Ian made a dissentient noise through his nose.
"Aye, and if I were to try being a friend, who would there be to protect the lot of them? Rachel and her brother and Dotty, I mean. You ken that, don't you? That they can only be what they are because you and I are what we are."
Jamie leaned back a little, purse-lipped, then gave him the ghost of a wry smile.
"I ken that fine, and so does Denzel Hunter. It's why he's here, though it's cost him his home and his meeting. But mind, they're worth protecting, beyond you being in love with Rachel, I mean."
"Mm-hmm."
Ian wasn't in the mood to discuss philosophy, and he doubted his uncle was either. The light was in that long hour before darkfall, when the things of the forest pause and draw breath, slowing for the night. It was a good time to hunt, because the trees slowed first, so you saw the animals still moving among them.
Uncle Jamie kent that.
He sat relaxed, nothing moving save his eyes. Ian saw his gaze flick up and turned his own head to see. Sure enough, a squirrel clung to the trunk of a sycamore 10 feet away. He'd not have seen it had he not caught the last flick of its tail as it stilled there. He met Jamie's eyes, and they both smiled and sat silent for a while, listening to the racket of the camp, even this beginning to mute itself.
Denzel and Dotty hadn't come back. Perhaps the birth was more complicated than Denny had thought. Rachel would be going to Jamie's tent soon for the meeting.
You wondered about that.
You needed a meeting to counsel the two of you, then to approve and witness the marriage. Might Denny have it in his mind to establish a new friends meeting, within which he could marry Dotty, and Rachel might wed Ian? Jamie sighed and stirred, getting ready to rise.
Uncle?
Ian said, in a casual tone that made his uncle instantly focus attention on him.
What? Said his uncle warily. You haven't got your last sweet child, have you?
I have not, Ian said, offended, and wondering vaguely how his uncle had known he was thinking of Rachel. And why would you think a thing like that, you evil-minded old mumper?
Because I ken well enough what,
uncle, usually means, Jamie informed him cynically.
It means you've got yourself into some confusion involving a lass and want advice. And I canna think what you could be confused about wi' regard to wee Rachel. A more straightforward lass I've never met. By your Auntie Clare, that is, he added with a brief grin.
Mm-hmm, Ian said, not best pleased by his uncle's acuity, but obliged to admit the truth of it.
Well, then, it's only...
Despite the completely benign intent, the innocence, even, of the question that had come into his mind, he felt his face grow hot. Jamie raised his brows.
Well, if you must know, then, I've never lain with a virgin.
Once he'd got it out, he relaxed a little, though his uncle's brows nearly met his hairline.
And I am sure Rachel is one, he added defensively.
I'm sure too,
his uncle assured him.
Most men wouldna consider it a problem.
Ian gave him a look.
You ken what I mean. I want her to like it.
Very commendable. Have you had complaints from women before?
You're in a rare mood, uncle, Ian said coldly.
You ken very well what I mean.
Aye, you mean if you're paying a woman to bed you, you're no likely to hear anything you dinna like regarding your own performance.
Jamie rocked back a little, eyeing him.
Did you tell Rachel you're in the habit of consorting wi' whores?
Ian felt the blood rush to his ears and was obliged to breathe evenly for a moment before replying.
I told her everything, he said between clenched teeth. And I wouldna call it a habit.
He did know better than to go on with,
it's no more than other men do,
because he can't find what sort of answer he'd get to that. Fortunately, Jamie seemed to have reined in his jocularity for the moment and was considering the question.
Your Mohawk wife, he said delicately. No,
Ian said. The Indians see bedding a bit differently. And seizing the opportunity to get a bit of his own back, added, Do you not recall the time we went to visit the snowbird Cherokee and birds sent a couple of maidens to warm your bed? Jamie gave him an old-fashioned sort of look that made him laugh.
Tell me, Ian, he said after a pause, would you be having this conversation with your da?
God, no.
I'm flattered, Jamie said dryly.
Well, see, Ian had answered by reflex and found himself fumbling for an explanation.
It's no that I wouldna talk to Da about things, but if he'd told me anything about, it would have been to do with him and Mam, wouldn't it? And I couldna.
Well,
I couldn't, that's all.
Mm-hmm.
Ian narrowed his eyes at his uncle.
You're no going to try and tell me that my mother,
who's my sister, aye? No, I wouldn't tell you anything like that.
I see your point. I'm only thinking...
He trailed off, and Ian gave him a pointed look. The light was fading, but there was still plenty. Jamie shrugged.
Aye, well, it's only... Your Auntie Clare was widowed when I wed her, aye?
Aye, so...
So it was me that was the virgin on our wedding night. Ian hadn't thought he'd moved, but Rollo jerked his head up and looked at him, startled.
Ian cleared his throat.
Oh, aye?
Aye, said his uncle, wry as a lemon. And I was given any amount of advice beforehand, too, by my uncle Dougal and his men.
Dougal Mackenzie had died before Ian was born, but he'd heard a good bit about the man one way and another. His mouth twitched.
Would you care to pass on any of it?
God, no.
Jamie stood up and brushed bits of bark from the tails of his coat.
I think you already can. You should be gentle about it, eh?
Ah, I had thought of that, Ian assured him.
Nothing else?
Ah, well. Jamie stood still, considering.
The only useful thing was what my wife told me on the night.
Go slowly and pay attention.
I think you can't go far wrong with that.
He settled his coat on his shoulders.
Au revoir, Ian. I'll see you at first light, if not somewhat before.
Au revoir, Uncle Jamie. As Jamie reached the edge of the clearing, Ian called after him.
Uncle Jamie?
Jamie turned to look over his shoulder.
Aye. And was she gentle with you?
God, no,
Jamie said, and grinned broadly. Chapter 58 Castrum Mutation. The sun was low in the sky by the time William reached Clinton's camp, and lower still before he'd turned Gough over to Sutherland's grooms. Zeb was nowhere in sight. Perhaps he was with Colenso. He delivered his cartouche of dispatches to Captain von Munchausen, saw the company clerk, and found the tent he shared with two other young captains, both of the 27th foot. Randolph Merbling was sitting outside reading by the last of the sun, but there was no sign of Thomas Evans, nor of Colenso Baragwanath, nor of Zebedee Jeffers, nor of William's baggage. He breathed for a moment, then shook himself like a dog shedding water. He was so tired of being angry that he just couldn't be asked any more. He shrugged, borrowed a towel from Merbling, washed his face, and went to find a bite to eat. He'd made up his mind not to think about anything whatever until he'd had some food, and largely succeeded, letting roast chicken, bread, cheese, and beer fill at least some of his empty spaces. As he finished, though, a sudden sharp image punctured his pleasant digestive reverie. A flushed, pretty face, with wary eyes the exact colour of the cider he was drinking. Jane. Bloody hell. What with one thing and another, he'd quite forgotten the whore and her sister. He'd told them to meet him at the surgeon's tent at sundown. Well, the sun wasn't down yet. He was on his feet and on his way, but then had a second thought, and, going back to the cook, wangled a couple of loaves and some cheese, just in case. Castrametation was the science of laying out a proper military camp. Drainage, sanitary trenches. Where to put the powder depot to avoid flooding if it rained. He'd had a brief course in it once. He'd likely never need to do it himself, but it did help in locating things if you knew where they were supposed to be. And when in camp, the hospital was meant to be on the opposite side from command headquarters, close to water, but on a height, if one was available. One was, and he found the large green canvas tent without difficulty. Could have found it with his eyes closed. Surgeons carried the smell of their work around with them, and the whiff of dried blood and their uneasy tang of sickness and recent death were perceptible at 100 yards. It was worse, much worse, after a battle. But there was always illness and accident, and the stink lingered even on peaceful days, aggravated now by the muggy heat that lay like a wet blanket over the camp. There were men, and not a few women, clustered round the tent, waiting for attention. He gave them a quick glance, but didn't see Jane. His heart had sped up a little at thought of seeing her, and he felt unaccountably disappointed. No reason why, he told himself. She and her sister would be nothing but trouble to him. They must have grown tired waiting, and...
"You're very late, my lord," said an accusatory voice at his elbow.
and he whirled round to see her looking down her nose at him, as well as someone who was shorter than he could do, which wasn't very well. He found himself smiling down at her absurdly.
"I said sundown," he replied mildly, nodding toward the west, where a thin slice of brilliance still glowed through the trees. "Not down yet, is it?"
"The sun takes a bloody long time to go down out here."
She switched her disapproval to the orb in question.
"It's much faster in the city."
Before he could argue with this ridiculous assertion, she'd glanced back at him, frowning.
"Why aren't you wearing your gorget?" she demanded, hands on her hips. "I went to a deal of trouble to get it back for you."
"I'm exceedingly grateful to you, ma'am," he said, striving for gravity.
"I thought it might provoke inquiries, though, should I turn up suddenly in the midst of camp wearing it. And I thought you and your sister might just possibly wish to avoid tedious explanations."
She sniffed, but not without amusement.
"How thoughtful. Not quite so thoughtful of your servants, though, are you?"
"What do you mean?"
"Come with me."
She linked her arm with his and towed him off toward the wood before he could protest. She led him to a small lean-to shelter in the undergrowth, which seemed to have been constructed of an unstuffed army bedsack and two petticoats. Bending down at her invitation, he discovered her sister Fanny within, sitting next to a bedsack that had been stuffed with fresh grass, upon which crouched both Colenso and Zeb, both looking bewildered. On sight of him, they crouched further.
"What the devil are you doing here?" he demanded. "And where is my dunnage, Zeb?"
"Back there, sir,"
Zeb quavered, jerking a thumb toward the growth behind the lean-to.
"I couldn't find your tent, and I didn't want to leave it, see?"
"But I told you—"
"And what about you, Baragwanath?
Are you still ill?"
William demanded, kneeling down suddenly and thrusting his head into the shelter. Colenso looked bad, pale as a cup of soured milk, and plainly in pain, curled up into himself.
"Oh, 'tisn't nothing, sir," he said, swallowing heavily. "Must just have ate something."
"Did you see the surgeon?"
Colenso turned his face into the bedsack, shoulders hunched. Zeb was edging away, apparently thinking of making a run for it. William grabbed him by the arm. The little groom yelped, and he let go.
"What's wrong? Did you not have that arm seen to?"
"They're afraid of the surgeons," Jane said sharply.
William drew himself up to his full height and glared down at her.
"Oh? Who told them they should be afraid of the surgeons? And how do they come to be in your care, may I ask?"
Her lips pressed tight together, and she glanced involuntarily into the shelter. Fanny was looking out at them, doe eyes huge in the fading light. She swallowed and put a protective hand on Colenso's shoulder. Jane sighed deeply and took William's arm again.
"Come with me."
She led him away a short distance, still within sight of the little shelter, but out of earshot.
"Fanny and I were waiting for you when those boys came along together. The bigger one. What did you say his name was?"
"Colenso Baragwanath. He's Cornish," William added shortly, seeing a look of amusement flit across her face.
"Really? I hope it isn't catching." "Well, he was so ill he couldn't stand, and sank down on the ground near us, making the most horrid noises. The little one, yes, I know he's Zebedee, thank you, was beside himself, half weeping with confusion. My sister is a most tender-hearted creature," she said, rather apologetically. "She went to help, and I followed." She shrugged. "We got Colenso into the wood far enough to get his breeches down in time, and I gave him a little water."
She touched a small wooden canteen that hung from her shoulder, and he wondered briefly where she'd got it. She hadn't had it when he'd met the girls by the creek yesterday.
"I'm much obliged to you, ma'am," he said formally. "Now, why is it exactly that you did not then take the boys in to see the surgeons?"
For the first time, her composure showed signs of cracking. She turned a little away from him, and he noticed the last rays of the sun polishing the smooth crown of her head with a faint, familiar gleam of chestnut. The sight of it brought back memory of his first meeting with her, with the force of a thunderclap. And with it, the memory of his mingled shame and arousal. Especially the latter.
"Answer me," he said, more roughly than he'd intended.
And she turned on him, eyes narrowed at his tone.
"There was a finger lying on the ground by the surgeon's tent," she snapped. "It frightened my sister, and the boys took fright from her."
William rubbed a knuckle down the bridge of his nose, eyeing her.
"A finger."
He had himself seen piles of amputated limbs outside the surgeon's tents at Saratoga, and aside from a quick prayer of gratitude that none of the disconnected arms and legs was his, had experienced no particular qualms.
"Whose was it?"
"How should I know? I was too much occupied in keeping your orderly from shitting himself to ask."
"Ah, yes. Thank you," he said rather formally.
He glanced toward the shelter again and was surprised to see that Fanny had come out and was hovering a little way from her sister, a wary look on her lovely face.
Did he look threatening, he wondered.
Just in case, he relaxed his posture a bit and smiled at Fanny. She didn't change expression, but continued to stare at him suspiciously. He cleared his throat and took the sack off his shoulder, holding it out to Jane.
"I thought you might have missed your supper. Have the boys, well, Zeb at least, eaten anything?"
Jane nodded and took the bag with a celerity suggesting that it had been some time since the girls had had a meal.
"He ate with the other grooms," he said.
"All right, then. I'll take him in to have his arms seen to and perhaps get a dose for Colenso while you and your sister refresh yourselves. Then, madam, we can discuss your own situation."
He'd been intensely aware of her physical presence for some moments, but when he said that, she turned the full effect of her eyes on him. Cider, he thought vaguely, or sherry wine, and seemed somehow to flow, shifting in some indefinable way. He hadn't seen her move, but suddenly she was standing near enough to touch, and he smelled the odour of her hair, and imagined he felt the warmth of her skin through her clothes. She took his hand briefly, and her thumb moved across the palm slowly. The palm tingled, and the hairs on his arm rippled.
"I'm sure we can come to a reasonable accommodation, my lord," she said, very grave, and let him go.
He dragged Zeb into the surgeon's tent like a recalcitrant colt, and stood by, only half attending as a young Scottish surgeon with freckles swabbed the boy's wound clean of dirt. Arabella Jane didn't smell of the whorish scent she'd worn at the brothel, but by Christ she smelled good.
"We should cauterize the wound, sir," the young doctor's voice was saying. "It will stop an abscess forming, aye?"
"No!" Jeb jerked away from the doctor and made a dash for the door, knocking into people and sending one woman flying with a shriek. Jolted out of his random thoughts, William made a reflexive dive and knocked the boy flat.
"Come on, Zeb," he said, hauling Zeb to his feet and propelling him firmly back to Dr. McFreckles. "It won't be that bad. Just a moment or two, and then it's all over."
Zeb, appearing patently unconvinced by this, William deposited him firmly on a stool and pulled up his own right cuff. "Look," he said, displaying the long, comet-shaped scar on his forearm. "That's what happens when you get an abscess." Both Zeb and the doctor peered at the scar, impressed. It had been a splinter wound, he told them, caused by a lightning-struck tree.
"Wandered round the Great Dismal Swamp for 3 days in a fever," he said. "Some Indians found me and got me to a doctor. I nearly died. And," he lowered his brows and gave Zeb a piercing look, "the doctor was just about to cut off my arm when the abscess burst and he cauterized it. You might not be so lucky, eh?"
Zeb still looked unhappy, but reluctantly agreed. William gripped him by the shoulders and said encouraging things while the iron was heating. But his own heart was beating as fast as it might have had he been awaiting cautery himself.
"Indians. One in particular."
He thought he'd exhausted his anger,
but there it bloody was again, bursting into bright, fresh flame like an ember smashed open with a poker. Bloody fucking Ian Murray, fucking Scott and sometime Mohawk. His bloody fucking cousin, which made it all that much worse. And then there was Rachel. Murray had taken him to Dr. Hunter and Rachel. He drew a deep, ragged breath, remembering her worn indigo gown hanging on its peg in the Hunter's house. Grabbing a handful of the cloth and pressing it to his face, breathing in her scent as though starved of air. That was where Murray had met Rachel himself. And now she was betrothed to that. Ow! Zeb writhed, and William realized belatedly that he was digging his fingers into the boy's shoulder, just like... He let go as though Zeb were a hot potato, feeling the memory of James Fraser's iron grip on his arm, and the agonizing pain that had numbed him from shoulder to fingertip. "Sorry," he said, voice shaking a little with the effort to hide his fury. "Sorry, Zeb." The surgeon was ready with the glowing iron. William took Zeb's arm as gently as he could and held it still while the thing was done. Rachel had held his own. He'd been right. It was quick. The surgeon pressed the hot iron to the wound and counted five, slowly, then took it away. Zeb went stiff as a tent pole and sucked in enough breath to supply three people, but didn't scream. "It's done," the doctor said, taking the iron away and smiling at Zeb. "Here. I'll put a bit of sweet oil on and bandage it. You did well, laddie." Zeb's eyes were watering, but he wasn't crying. He sniffed deeply and wiped the back of his hand across his face, looking up at William. "Well done, Zeb," William said, squeezing his shoulder gently. And Zeb managed a tiny smile in return. By the time they'd returned to the girls and Colenso, William had managed to tamp down the rage again. Was he never going to be able to get rid of it? "Not till you make up your mind what to do about things," he thought grimly. But there wasn't anything that could be done right now, so he squashed all the sparks back in his head firmly into one dense red ball and rolled it to the back of his mind. "Here, let Fanny do it. He trusts her." Jane took the vial containing the dose Dr. McFreckles had made up for Colenso and gave it to her sister. Fanny promptly sat down beside Colenso, who was pretending as hard as he could to be asleep, and began stroking his head, murmuring something to him. William nodded, and, gesturing to Jane to accompany him, withdrew far enough to be out of earshot. Rather to his surprise, part of his brain had apparently been analysing the problem and coming to conclusions while the rest was occupied. For he had a rough plan.
"What I suggest is this," he said without preamble. "I will make provision for you and your sister to receive regular army rations as camp followers and to travel under my protection. Once in New York, I will give you £5 and you're on your own. In return..." She didn't quite smile, but a dimple showed in one cheek. "In return," he repeated more firmly, "you will mind my orderly and my groom, tend their ills, and make sure they're reasonably cared for. You will also be my laundress."
"Your laundress?"
The dimple had disappeared abruptly, replaced by an expression of sheer astonishment. "Laundress," he repeated doggedly. He knew what she had been expecting him to propose, and was rather surprised himself that he hadn't. But there it was. He couldn't. Not with his thoughts of Rachel and of Anne Endicott so fresh in his mind. Not with the deep, smothered rage fueled by the thought that he deserved no woman but a whore.
"But I don't know how to do laundry."
"How hard can it be?" he asked as patiently as he could. "You wash my clothes. Don't put starch in my drawers. That's about it, isn't it?"
But... She looked aghast. "One needs a kettle, a fork, a paddle, something to stir with. Soap. I haven't any soap."
Oh, that hadn't occurred to him. "Well,
He dug in his pocket, found it empty, and tried the other, which held a guinea, tuppence, and a florin. He handed her the guinea.
Buy what you need, then.
She looked at the golden coin in her palm, her face utterly blank. She opened her mouth, then closed it again.
What's the matter? He asked impatiently.
She didn't answer, but a soft voice behind him did.
She doesn't know how.
He whirled to find Fanny looking up at him from under her cap, her delicate cheeks flushed red by the sunset.
What did you say?
Fanny's soft mouth pressed tight, and her cheeks grew redder, but she repeated it, dogged.
She doesn't know how.
Jane reached Fanny in two steps, putting an arm around her sister's shoulders and glaring at William. My sister's tongue-tied, she said, daring him to say anything. That's why she's afraid of the surgeons. She thinks they will amputate her tongue if they find out. He drew a deep, slow breath.
I see. And what she said to me, she doesn't know how. She means you, I collect. What is it, pray, that you don't know how?
Muddy,
whispered Fanny, now staring at the ground.
Mud. Money?
He stared at Jane.
You don't know how to...
I've never had any money,
she snapped, and threw the guinea on the ground at his feet. I know the names of the coins, but I don't know what you can buy with them except... Except what you can buy in a brothel. My cunt is worth 6 shillings, all right? My mouth is 3, and my arse is 1 pound. But if someone gave me 3 shillings, I wouldn't know if I could buy a loaf of bread or a horse with them. I've never bought anything.
You mean...
He was so flabbergasted he couldn't string words into a sentence.
But you have wages? You said...
I've been a brothel whore since I was 10 years old.
Her fist clenched. Knuckles sharp under the skin.
I never see my wages.
Mrs. Abbott spends them, she says, for my, our, food and clothes.
I've never had a penny to my name, let alone spent one. And now you hand me that.
She stamped her foot on the guinea, driving it into the ground.
And tell me to buy a kettle? Where? How? From whom?
Her voice shook. And her face was a deal redder than the setting sun could make it. She was furious, but also very near to tears. He wanted to take her in his arms and soothe her, but thought that might be a good way to lose a finger.
How old is Fanny? He asked instead.
She jerked her head up, panting.
Fanny, she said blankly. I'm 11.
Fanny's voice said behind him.
You leave her alone.
He turned to see the girl glaring up at him, a stick clutched in her hand. He might have laughed if not for the expression on her face, and if not for what he'd just realized. He took a step back so as to see both girls at once, and, like magnet and iron, they came together and clung, both staring distrustfully at him.
How much is her maidenhead worth? He asked Jane baldly, with a nod at Fanny.
10 pounds,
Fanny answered automatically, just as Jane shouted, She's not for sale, to you or any other bugger. She pressed Fanny fiercely closer, daring him to make a move toward the girl.
I don't want her, he said through his teeth. I don't fornicate with children, for God's sake.
Jane's hard expression didn't alter. And she didn't loosen her grip on her sister.
Then why did you ask?
To verify my suppositions regarding your presence here.
Jane snorted. Those being?
That you ran away.
Presumably because your sister has now reached an age where... He raised an eyebrow, nodding at Fanny. Jane's lips compressed, but she gave him a tiny, grudging nod.
Captain Harkness, he asked.
It was a shot in the dark, but well aimed. Harkness hadn't been pleased at being deprived of his prey, and, unable to come at William, might well have decided to take his revenge elsewhere. The light bathed everything in tones of gold and lavender, but he could see Jane's face go pale nonetheless, and felt a tightening in his loins. If he found Harkness. He resolved to go looking tomorrow. The man might be in Philadelphia, as she'd said, but he might not. It would be a welcome focus for his rage. Right then, he said, as matter-of-factly as he could. He stooped and pried the guinea out of the soft earth, realizing as he did so that he'd been a fool to offer it to her. Not because of what she'd told him, but because someone like her, or Colenso, would never have such a sum. They'd be suspected of stealing it, and very likely would be relieved of it by the first person to see it. "Just look after the boys, will you?" he said to Jane. "And the both of you, keep clear of the soldiers until I can find you simple clothes." "Dressed like that," he gestured at their dust-smudged, sweat-stained finery. "You'll be taken for whores. And soldiers don't take no for an answer."
"I am a whore," Jane said in a strange, dry voice.
"No," he said, and felt his own voice as oddly separate from himself but very firm. "You're not. You travel under my protection. I'm not a pimp, so you're not a whore. Not until we reach New York."
Chapter 59. A Discovery in the Ranks. The 16th Pennsylvania Militia Company, Captain the Reverend Peleg Woodsworth in command, marched into camp in good order, having paused just outside to tidy themselves, clean their weapons, and wash their faces. Lord John knew no one would take notice, but approved of the preparations on grounds of good military discipline, as he explained to Germain. "Slovenly troops make bad fighters," he said, critically examining a large rent in the sleeve of his filthy black coat. "And soldiers must be in the habit of obeying orders, no matter what those orders are."
Germain nodded. "Aye, that's what my mum says. Doesn't matter whether you see the point or not. You do as you're told, or else."
"Your mother would make an admirable sergeant," Grey assured his orderly.
He'd encountered Marsali Fraser once or twice at her print shop.
"Splendid grasp of the essence of command. Speaking of or else, though, what exactly do you expect to happen when you go home?"
It was evident that Germain hadn't given much thought to the prospect, but after a moment he uncreased his brow.
"Likely it'll depend how long I've been gone," he said with a shrug. "If I went back tomorrow, I'd get my ears blistered and my arse too. But I think, if I was to be gone longer than a week, she'd be pleased I wasn't a deed."
"Ah. Have you heard the story of the prodigal son, by chance?"
"No, my lord. Bert." Germain coughed. "How does it go?"
"It's..."
He began automatically, but then stopped dead, feeling as though a stake had been driven through his chest. The company had already begun to fray and struggle. The few men behind him merely skirted him and went past. Germain twisted round to see what he was looking at.
"It's that man who pretends to be a Frenchman. My father doesn't like him."
Grey stared at the gentleman in the suit of very fashionable blue and grey striped silk, who was likewise staring at Grey, mouth slightly open, ignoring the small knot of Continental officers accompanying him.
"I know a lot of Frenchmen," Grey said, recovering his breath. "But you're right, that's not one of them."
He turned his back on the man, mind a whirl, and gripped Germain by the arm.
"Your grandfather has to be in this moil somewhere," he said, forcing resolution into his voice. "Do you see the building over there with the flag?"
He nodded at the limp banner on the far side of the sprawling camp, but clearly visible.
"Go there. That will be the Commander-in-Chief's headquarters. Tell one of the officers who you're looking for. They'll find him for you among the militia."
"Oh, they won't have to," Germain assured him. "Grandpère will be there."
"Where?"
"With General Washington," Germain said, with the exaggerated patience of those forced to consort with dunces. "He's a general, too. Did you not know that?"
Before Grey could respond to this piece of flabbergasting intelligence, Germain had scampered away in the direction of the distant banner. Grey risked a glance over his shoulder, but Perseverance Wainwright had disappeared, as had the Continental officers, leaving only a couple of lieutenants in conversation. He thought several blasphemous things in a row, alternating between Jamie Fraser and Percy Wainwright as the recipients of assorted violent assaults of a personal nature. What the fucking hell was either of them doing here? His fingers twitched, wanting to strangle someone, but he fought back this useless impulse in favour of deciding what the devil to do now. He began to walk hastily, with no clear notion where he was going. Percy had seen him, he knew that much. Jamie hadn't, but might at any moment. A general? What the... No time to worry about that just now. What might either one of them do about it? He hadn't seen Percy, ex-lover, ex-brother, French spy, and all-around shit, since their last conversation in Philadelphia some months before. When Percy had first reappeared in Grey's life, it had been with a last attempt at seduction. Political rather than physical, though Grey had an idea that he wouldn't have balked at the physical either. It was an offer for the British government, the return to France of the valuable Northwest Territory, in return for the promise of Percy's interests to keep the French government from making an alliance with the American colonies. He had, as a matter of duty, conveyed the offer discreetly to Lord North, and then expunged it, and Percy, from his mind. He had no idea what, if anything, the First Minister had made of it. Too late now, in any case, he thought. France had signed a treaty with the rebellious colonies in April. It remained to be seen, though, whether that treaty would result in anything tangible in the way of support. The French were notoriously unreliable. So, now what? His instinct towards self-preservation urged him to fade quietly through the camp and disappear as quickly as possible. Germain wouldn't tell Jamie he was here. They'd agreed that much in advance. Two considerations held him back, though. First, the minor matter that he didn't yet know where the British Army was or how far away. And second, a sense of curiosity about Percy that he himself recognised as dangerously reckless. He'd kept moving, since to stand still was to be knocked over and trampled, and now found himself walking beside the Reverend Woodsworth. The tall minister's face was suffused with an excitement that kept breaking through the man's normal mien of calm dignity, and Grey couldn't help smiling at it.
"God has brought us safe thus far, Bert," Woodsworth said, looking about him with shining eyes. "And he will grant us victory. I know it."
"Ah." Grey groped for some reply, and finding, to his surprise, that he was incapable of agreeing with his statement, settled for,
"I suppose we cannot presume to divine the Almighty's intent, but I do trust he will preserve us in his mercy." "Very well said, Bert. Very well said."
And Woodsworth clapped him resoundingly on the back. Chapter 60. Quakers and Quartermasters. Jamie found Nathaniel Green in his tent and still in shirt sleeves, the remains of breakfast on a table before him, frowning at a letter in his hand. He put this down at once upon seeing Jamie and rose to his feet.
"Come in, sir, do. Have you had anything yet today? I've a spare egg going to waste."
He smiled, but briefly. Whatever had troubled him about the letter still lurked in the creases of his brow. Jamie glanced at it from the corner of his eye. From the blots and ragged edge, it looked a piece of domestic correspondence, rather than an official note.
"I have, I thank you, sir,"
Jamie said, with a slight bow of acknowledgement toward the egg, which sat neglected in a little wooden cup with a flowered heart painted on it.
"I only wondered if you meant to ride out today. Might I come with you?"
"Of course."
Green looked surprised but pleased.
"I should welcome your advice, General."
Perhaps we might trade wisdom, then, Jamie suggested. For I should value your own advice, though, perhaps on a different matter.
Green paused, coat half pulled on.
Really? Advice on what sort of matter? Marriage?
Green's face struggled between astonishment, a courteous attempt to suppress the astonishment, and something else. He glanced behind him at the letter lying on the table and settled his coat on his shoulders.
I could use sound advice on that matter myself, General Fraser, he said, with a wry twist of the lips. Let us be off, then.
They rode out of camp north by northwest. Green was equipped with a battered compass, and Jamie wished for a moment that he still possessed the gold-plated astrolabe that William had sent from London at the behest of Lord John. That had perished when the big house burned, though the spurt of dark feeling that went through him now had more to do with the thought of John Grey than with the fire and its aftermath. Conversation at first dealt only with the business at hand, the location of supply dumps along the probable line of march, and, if necessary, retreat, though no one spoke of that possibility. There was no particular doubt as to where the British army was headed. A body that large, with an enormous baggage train and outlying flocks of camp followers, was limited in its choice of roads.
"Aye, that would do," Jamie said, nodding in agreement at Green's suggestion of an abandoned farmstead. "Do you think the well's good?" "I'm minded to find out," Green said, turning his horse's head toward the farm. "It's hot as Hades already. Scorch Harrier's off by noon, I reckon."
It was hot. They'd left off their stocks and waistcoats and were riding in shirt sleeves, coats across their saddle bows. But Jamie felt the linen of his shirt sticking to his back and sweat trickling over his ribs and down his face. Fortunately, the well was still good. Water glimmered visibly below, and a stone dropped in gave back a satisfactory plunk.
"I confess I'm surprised to find you in want of advice regarding marriage, General," Green said, having first drunk his fill and then upended a bucketful of water luxuriously over his head. He blinked water off his lashes, shook himself like a dog, and handed the bucket to Jamie, who nodded thanks. "I should have thought your own union most harmonious." "Aye, well, it's not my own marriage I'm worried for," Jamie said, grunting a little as he pulled up a fresh, full bucket, hand over hand, for the windlass had rotted away, and he'd been obliged to fetch a rope from his saddlebag. "Will you ken a young scout named Ian Murray? He's my nephew." Murray. Murray!
Green looked blank for a moment, but then comprehension dawned.
"Oh, him! Yes, drat him! Your nephew, you say? Thought he was an Indian. Cost me a guinea on that race. My wife won't be happy about that at all. Not that she's happy at the moment, regardless," he added with a sigh.
Evidently, the letter had been domestic.
"Well, I might persuade him to give it you back," Jamie said, suppressing a smile, "if you might be able to help him to wed."
He raised the bucket overhead and gave himself over to a moment of joy as the drench of water quenched the heat. He drew one deep, grateful breath of coolness, tasting of the dank stones at the bottom of the well, and likewise shook himself.
"He means to marry a Quaker lass," he said, opening his eyes. "I kent that you were a friend yourself, having heard you speak to Mrs. Hardman when we met. So I wondered maybe if you could tell me just what's needed in the way of requirement for such a marriage."
If Green had been surprised to find that Ian was Jamie's nephew, this news seemed to knock him speechless. He stood for a moment, pushing his lips in and out as though they might suck up a word he could spit back out, and at last found one.
"Well," he said.
He paused for a bit,